Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bill Hartung of the World Policy Institute, who assesses the Bush administration's reaction to the public unraveling of their brash pronouncements justifying the war in Iraq. Mazin Qumsia, co-founder of Al-Auda or the Palestinian Right to Return Coalition, who looks at the controversy surrounding the construction of a security barrier separating Israel from Palestinian territory in the West Bank. And Kim Ives, an editor with the newspaper Haiti Progrès, who assesses the violence which has engulfed Haitian cities as opposition groups attempt to overthrow President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The London-based Observer newspaper reports that the Israeli army is under growing criticism to explain its aggressive tactics against Palestinians during a three-week sweep in the West Bank city of Nablus. The Israeli military operation that started on December 16, 2003, was designed to track down Naif Sharek, who the army claims is the mastermind behind a series of suicide bombing attacks in Israel. A late-night raid on January 6th resulted in the deaths of 19 people, including four militia gunmen and 15 unarmed civilians. According to The Observer, two cases had the markings of execution by Israeli soldiers. Human rights groups are calling on the Israeli army to completely investigate the incidents. One case involves 21-year-old Ala Dawaya, a baker who was shot by soldiers as he went to work. He was still alive when an ambulance drove by. As the ambulance turned around, Israeli soldiers fired more shots into Dawaya. At Rafidia Hospital, Dr. Samir Abu Zarur concluded that the victim, who was carrying a bag with extra clothes and identification, was shot 10 times, including twice in the face and once in the testicles. During a late-night sweep on January 7th, 25-year-old Abdul Qassas was taken out of his house and questioned by soldiers. He was found dead early the next morning. Upon examination by Dr. Zarur, it appeared to the doctor that the young man was kneeling before he was shot twice and killed at close range. An attorney for the Palestinian Human Rights Monitoring Group is expected to petition the Israeli military attorney general, asking him to investigate. The decade-long scandal of hundreds of unsolved murders of poor young women in the industrial city of Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, is now affecting the credibility of Mexican President Vicente Fox. The political damage to Fox follows a massive 1,500-page report that was recently released by Mexico's National Commission on Human Rights that unearthed a pattern of indifference to the murdered women by law enforcement and corruption in handling various cases. An editorial in the conservative El Universal newspaper exclaimed, "The gravity of these allegations in any other country would be sufficient cause to demand the resignations of the entire chain of political, police, and prosecutorial authorities." According to the World Press Review magazine, information uncovered by several Mexican newspapers link four business people in the state of Chihuahua to an underground network of drug traffickers who are believed to have carried out many of the kidnappings and murders of poor women. At least two of the business people identified have close ties to Fox and his conservative National Action Party. So far, Mexico's federal government has not launched an aggressive investigation to arrest and prosecute the killers and punish corrupt police and public officials. Just off Highway 53 in rural North Carolina, union organizers are visiting the modest homes of the mostly Latino workforce of Smithfield Foods hog processing plant in nearby Tar Heel. The factory is the biggest hog processing facility in the world. Like most of the Smithfield workers, Evelyn Ortiz is a Latino immigrant. The native of Chiapas, Mexico, feels she has gotten a raw deal from the meat processor. As Ortiz tells organizers from the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, she used to work 50 hours a week in 35-degree temperatures, but never was paid overtime. James Blount, a former Smithfield supervisor, says the food giant regularly set back the time clock to cheat workers out of overtime pay. Despite the abuses, the UFCW has not been able to win a union election at the hog plant. According to Amnesty International, the food giant has defeated two union drives in the 1990s by hiring anti-union consultants and firing pro-union workers. In December 2000, the National Labor Relations Board ruled that Smithfield Foods had committed egregious and pervasive violations of worker rights during a 1997 union organizing campaign. The Labor Board concluded that the management had conspired with local law enforcement to instigate violence and ordered the company to reinstate 11 workers who were fired illegally for participating in pro-union activity. Smithfield has appealed the ruling. As former Supervisor Sherry Bufkin told a U.S. Senate committee in 2002, "I am here to tell you that Smithfield Foods ordered me to fire employees who supported the union, and the company told me that it was either my job or theirs. Southfield Foods also told me to lie on an affidavit and made me choose between my job and telling the truth." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
Soon after David Kaye, the former chief U.S. weapons inspector in Iraq, declared publicly that Saddam Hussein's regime likely possessed no weapons of mass destruction at the time of last year's U.S. invasion, the Bush administration came under pressure to agree to the establishment of an independent commission to investigate the issue. After initially resisting the idea, the president agreed to set up such a panel, but with members he alone would select. The bipartisan commission will be co-chaired by Lawrence Silberman, a Republican activist and retired federal judge, and moderate Democrat Charles Robb, former governor and senator from Virginia. Other members include GOP Senator John McCain, Richard Levin, president of Yale University, and Lloyd Cutler, former legal counsel for two Democratic presidents. But administration critics point out that the commission won't issue a final report until well after November's election. They also complain that the commission's mandate will narrowly focus on intelligence failures and how to fix them, not on the central question asked around the world: did the White House manipulate intelligence to gain support for the war? With many public opinion polls showing Mr. Bush running behind Democratic candidate John Kerry, the president recently appeared as a guest on TV's Meet the Press program to explain his position on the war and why Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction have not been found. But his performance was not highly rated even by some longtime Republican allies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bill Hartung, director of the Arms Trade Research Center at the World Policy Institute, who assesses the Bush administration's reaction to the very public unraveling of their brash pronouncements justifying the war in Iraq.
Kaye himself tried to provide some protective cover for them by saying, well, you know, we were all wrong here. Everybody thought he had some sort of weapons of mass destruction. It wasn't a case of manipulation of intelligence. It was just a, sort of an honest mistake. So Kaye was already trying to spin the issue in a way that would be least damaging to Bush. But, of course, that was not sufficient because the Bush folks had very clearly said that Saddam had specific chemical and biological weapons, that he was rapidly reconstituting his nuclear weapons, that he was an imminent threat to the United States, that was the reason we needed to go to war immediately. Back when Hans Blix, in the run-up to the war, was saying that they needed more time to document whether he had destroyed his past weapons, dismantled programs, and so forth, they were very clear they couldn't possibly wait another week, another month, and so forth. And, you know, that turnaround from saying that the threat was imminent, that the weapons existed, to now saying, oh, well, gee, maybe we were wrong about that, has forced Bush now to form a presidential commission to look into this. But, of course, he's picking all the members, and it's reporting well after the election. And he wants it to look at a whole range of issues. One of the issues he doesn't want to look at is how his office, the Pentagon, Dick Cheney's office, were leaning on professional intelligence analysts the whole time to get them to throw out anything that cast doubt on Iraq's intentions and capabilities in terms of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, and to hype anything that indicated that he might be a rising danger, and also to take evidence from defectors who were notoriously unreliable and throw that immediately out into the public square without any kind of vetting, any kind of corroboration from other sources and so forth. So I think Bush's best fallback so far has been this sort of notion that Hussein was the great and gathering threat, which is the term that they seem to like to use. The idea is, well, we just got there really early. You know, this was a bad guy. He was going to do something eventually. We just
thought he was further along than he was, but they're trying to definitely sell it, you know, as an honest mistake, not as what it was, which was them manipulating intelligence, manipulating the public to push a war that they wanted from day one, as Paul O'Neill has revealed in the recent book that Ron Suskin did with his assistants.
The Commission of Inquiry that President Bush has set up has somewhat of a vague mission. Its credibility is in question, especially with many Democrats running for Mr. Bush's seat in the White House. And then, of course, the date of the final report is well after this November's election. So how much credibility does this so-called bipartisan commission have? And do you think that the Democrats and John Kerry as the front runner for the Democratic nomination, do you think the Democrats will be challenging the credibility of this thing?
I think they will, and I hope they stick with it. You know, I hope they don't just sort of do it for a day or two, fall by the wayside. I think the fact that Bush's appearance on Meet the Press was not particularly well received. Even Peggy Noonan, the Reagan speechwriter, sort of said, you know, I was one who was not particularly impressed with Bush's performance, and she usually tries her best to be a good Republican stalwart when she can, you know, stand to. I think their public relations offensive has not gone well on this. So it could be that if the Democrats keep criticizing this thing and don't just sort of treat it as if it's a real inquiry, that they may be able to somewhat delegitimize it in the public eye. The judge, Silberman, that they put on it, among other things, was the one who sort of semi-pardoned Oliver North in the Iran-Contra days, because North claimed he would have had to use classified material in his defense. So it doesn't, on the face of it, sound like a guy who's going to push too hard on issues like whether we should look at how the administration manipulated intelligence.
John Kerry has adopted a lot of Howard Dean's blunt talk about the war and about the credibility of the Bush administration. But, of course, Senator Kerry also voted for the war resolution, which allowed Bush to send the troops to Iraq last March. What kind of challenge do you think Senator Kerry has in taking on the war issue, the weapons of mass destruction issue, as he goes head-to-head with Bush, presumably as the party's nominees, what it looks like right now, this campaign season?
Kerry was not exactly a profile in courage when it counted, when the vote for war was taken. On the other hand, you know, I think he would be far preferable to the Bush crowd, because Bush has surrounded himself with a bunch of radical ideologues who seem to believe that military power is the solution to almost every global problem. You know, I guess the question will be, given that Kerry is somewhat compromised, you know, he voted for the war, and then he said it was because he wanted to strengthen the president's hand, to go to the UN and so forth. Is that kind of Clinton-esque, you know, wanting to be on both sides of the issue, going to make it harder for him to, you know, really pursue Bush on this? Or will it just be, that was then, this is now, and does he see blood in the water? And at least as a, you know, tactical political matter, will he be perfectly able of sort of shifting gears? Then, of course, you know, the question would be, if he could beat Bush, what are we getting? I mean, are we getting the Kerry who flip-flopped on the war? Or are we getting the new populist, straight-talking Kerry? And that'll be a tougher question to answer.
That was Bill Hartung of the World Policy Institute. Contact the Institute at area code 212-229-5808 or visit the group's website at www.worldpolicy.org. Bill Hartung is the author of How Much Are You Making on the War, Daddy?, A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, published by Nation Books. The Israeli government has announced that it is altering its construction of what it calls a security barrier to be closer to the recognized boundaries between Israel and the West Bank and to be less intrusive into Palestinian territory. The barrier is now planned to be 420 miles rather than the original 480 miles, and construction, which is one-fourth complete, continues. The Palestinian Authority, which opposes construction of the barrier, says adjustments to the wall's route are unacceptable. The legitimacy of the wall is now being challenged at both the International Court of Justice in The Hague, which can issue only an advisory ruling, and the Israeli Supreme Court, where the Association for Civil Rights in Israel contends the barrier infringes on Palestinian rights. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mazin Kumsia, co-founder of Al-Oda or the Palestinian Right to Return Coalition. He talks about the wall and about his conviction that the only just solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a one-state solution where Jews, Muslims, and Christians can live together as equals.
We call it apartheid or segregation wall. It's intended to put Palestinians in Bantustans, basically, or ghettos, surrounded by these huge walls, fences, ditches, and security barriers that are intended to basically impoverish them, isolate them in such a way that they would eventually give up and leave. It's separating Palestinians from other Palestinians. It's separating Palestinians from their farms and lands. The wall is being built in the occupied areas. It's not being built as a fence between Israel and the occupied area. It's being built inside the occupied areas, and it's surrounding Palestinian towns and villages, and it cuts very deep into those areas, creating Bantustans, basically four of them, three in the West Bank and one in Gaza.
Even people who don't necessarily support the wall say that the Israelis are building it to try to prevent suicide bombers from coming into, you know, inside the Green Line, and you're not even talking about that at all. You didn't mention that.
The barrier, I mean, is not a barrier for security. It does not provide security for Israelis. In fact, there's been studies that show that would increase security risks for the Israelis. For example, Israel cites that the wall around Gaza Strip reduced suicide bombings. If that is the case, why is Israeli soldiers, thousands of them, a whole division is in Gaza Strip that's already surrounded by fences, and why is this division demolishing thousands of Palestinian homes on the other side of the fence that already exists in the Gaza Strip? So the reality of it is that the wall is not about security. The wall is about impoverishment and about control and about entrenching an occupation that's illegal by international law.
What do you think about what they're calling now the Geneva Accords, these proposals to basically arrive at a settlement between Palestine and Israel?
The Geneva Accord, just like the roadmap, failed to mention human rights and international law. Those four words, two main things, are ignored in the Geneva Accord. And without human rights and without international law, there can be no peace. The Geneva Accord are basically sellout accords by some Palestinian puppet leaders in the West Bank who think that they are representing the Palestinians, when in reality most Palestinians think of them as collaborators with Israel and are trying to implement a solution that has been tried in South Africa and has failed. The solution being, or the thought about solution being, that we can segregate Palestinians, put them in a small area and call it a state, and then that would solve Israel's demographic and other problems. You cannot do that. You cannot ignore international law. You cannot ignore the right of refugees to return to their homes and lands and call it a solution that will bring peace. It will never bring peace. It will only bring more bloodshed.
What is your take on what the majority of Palestinians would like to see?
When we talk about Israeli public opinion and Palestinian public opinion, and we talk about two sides, this implies some sort of a parity or equality between Israel and the Palestinians. Israel is a colonial occupying power that ethnically cleansed 530 Palestinian villages, so that 5 million of the 9 million Palestinians are refugees or displaced people. They don't really have a voice in what these arrangements are being made. Obviously, the Palestinians all support resistance to the occupation. Some of them support resistance by different means, by nonviolent means. Some of them support it by violent means. And on the extreme, there are some who support suicide bombings.
Describe a little more about why you believe that a one-state solution is the only possible solution to this very difficult-to-solve problem, and what that would look like.
I mean, it would be exactly like happened in South Africa. In South Africa, you do not divide between the whites and the blacks. That does not work. That's number one. Number two is within the state of Israel. Even if Israel, by miracle, withdraws from all the West Bank and Gaza, which I don't believe is possible because there are 400,000 Israeli colonists and settlers in the West Bank and Gaza who are not going to vacate, simply. And there's no way that you can have a viable Palestinian state on 22% of Palestine and even carve it up even more to accommodate these 400,000 settlers, or at least the majority of them. But even if Israel withdraws from the West Bank and Gaza and allows the Palestinian state truly sovereign in the West Bank and Gaza, that still leaves a problem of the fact that within the Green Line, in the areas that Israel would end up controlling, there are 1.3 million Palestinians, and they include Christians and Muslims. And Israel needs to become a state of its citizens and not a state for the Jewish people.
That was Mazin Kumsia, co-founder of Al-Auda or the Palestinian Right to Return Coalition. For more information, visit the group's website at www.al-awda.org. Mazin Kumsia is the author of Sharing the Land of Canaan, soon to be published by Pluto Press. Escalating violence between opponents and supporters of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide has seen armed rebel groups take over Haiti's fourth-largest city, Gonaïves, and conflicts in nearly a dozen other cities and towns. The rebellion by former soldiers and those unhappy with the Aristide government comes after opposition groups refused to enter into negotiations with the president over future legislative elections. These groups demand that Aristide resign 2 years before his term in office expires. Jean-Bertrand Aristide was elected president of Haiti in 1990 after decades of brutal dictatorship under the U.S.-backed Duvalier family. But a military coup cut short Aristide's presidency in 1991 after just 7 months in office. The former Catholic priest who fled into exile was returned to power in 1994 after a combined U.S.-UN military force ousted the coup makers. Aristide left office in 1995 when his term ended and was re-elected president in 2000. Tensions rose in Haiti after opposition parties, backed by the U.S., charged that the May 2000 legislative election was corrupted by fraud. Washington's decision to then block the flow of millions of dollars in economic aid exacerbated an already dire situation for the poorest nation in the hemisphere. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kim Ives, an editor with the newspaper Haiti Progrès, who had just returned from a visit to Haiti. Ives takes a look at the chaotic situation there and examines the makeup of Haiti's opposition groups.
The vast, vast majority of Haitians are opposed to any kind of coup d'etat. They experienced that once 3 years ago, and some 5,000 people died during that coup. And one of their watchwords is, nous pas marrons encore, that is, we will not go into hiding again. So one of the things I saw after the opposition had said they were going to have a demonstration was hundreds, thousands of popular organization youths and young men, old men, women, children, building barricades, setting fires, some of them armed with automatic rifles, taking to the street to block what they see as a coup coming from the former army of Haiti as well as Washington and France. There's no doubt that Washington and Paris and the European Union are backing the opposition. The armed wing of the opposition is becoming really more and more bold now, is coming to the fore. This is primarily former soldiers, plus I think a lot of infiltrated people. So what's happening now is really battle for Gonaïves, fourth largest city, city of the independence declaration that was made in 1804, where Aristide on January 1st managed to hold a bicentennial celebration, much to the chagrin of the opposition, and now they're really cutting loose with everything they have. On February 7th, the 18th anniversary of the fall of the Duvalier dictatorship, some estimate 1 million, and it was anywhere between 500,000 and a million, that would be one-eighth of Haiti's population, came out into the streets of Port-au-Prince and essentially said they wanted elections, and they did not want another coup d'etat.
What, in your view, is the danger for Aristide in terms of the coming days with armed groups in the streets taking over cities? The violence certainly could get out of control. What's the likelihood that those armed groups would attempt an assault directly on the presidential palace and to try and drive Aristide out of power in the coming weeks?
Well, this is one of the scenarios. I think the two far greater threats are from the what they call the Samama army, the motherless army, which is essentially a pseudo contra force. It's very similar to the Contras in Nicaragua that have been based in Honduras, and the parallels are there. It's across the border from the Dominican Republic, which functions as a sort of annex to the Pentagon. It is practically a Honduras with a 25,000 member army, a lot of Pentagon activity there. It's clear that this contraforce, which had been functioning on the Central Plateau, which is a rural area just across the border from the Dominican Republic, where they'd been beaten back a couple of times and run back across the border. But now they've infiltrated, particularly Gonaive, St. Mark, and it looks like they're making some efforts around Cape Haitian. So it's possible these people could launch an assault on the palace as they did once before. But to me, the bigger danger is really foreign intervention from the Dominican Republic, where I think the U.S., even though it's tied up in Iraq and Afghanistan now, might use the Dominicans as a kind of a proxy army to come in. Haiti only has a 4,500-member police force. In one scenario that is talked about in Haiti, then the United Nations or OAS would say, well, we have an international conflict between DR and Haiti, and they would quickly come in and put in some kind of peacekeeping force. So we're looking down the barrel of another possible intervention.
Are there any fingerprints that you can point to that directly tie the Bush administration in with this latest violence in Haiti?
No, just the MOs, just the patterns are so similar. The main thing we can point to is the money that has been funneled from Washington. It's some $120 million that has gone to via NGOs and so forth to the opposition. I mean, we have to remember this is this ultra-radical right-wing group, Noriega, Otto Reich, Negroponte. These are the architects of the war against the Sandinistas, and these are, you know, holy warriors. They are on a crusade, as George Bush himself has said.
That was Kim Ives, an editor with the newspaper Haiti Progrès. Contact Haiti Progrès by calling area code 718-434-8100 or visit their website at www.haitiprogrès.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Sasha Summer Cousineau, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.